Welcome to Thursday Night Talk, The Race Beat. I'm Lorna Bryant, live from the Kate Buchanan Room at Humboldt State University. This is a two-hour radio event, so if you have a cell phone, please turn your phone off at this time. There will be a couple of ground rules. This is live radio. There are FCC rules. Because of that, please limit your explicit language, not to a minimum, but zero. That won't be allowed on the air. After 9 o'clock, you're on your own. This show will be in two parts. In the first hour, we'll talk about this upcoming presidency. That will occur in 12 hours or so. We will talk about what this presidency, this upcoming administration, means to our community and our country. In the first hour, we'll talk about some of the political or legal aspects. In the second hour, we will talk about the personal aspects, how it will affect us individually, our children, our families, our neighbors. So we will start in the first hour with our guests introducing themselves and giving us a little bit of background information about who you are and why you're here. Jeff?
Hi, I'm Jeff Blank. I'm here representing the local branch of the NAACP. I've been a member since for over 12, 13 years. I was president of the Reno Sparks branch in Nevada. I was the first white president there in its 70-year history. And I've been going, I've attended like seven or eight national conventions. I've presented on the school-to-prison pipeline at the legal convention twice. I'm married to a wonderful woman, Sharon, and we have two black sons.
Good evening, Lorna. My name is Don Peterson. I am the chief of police here at Humboldt State University. Have been in law enforcement for about 32 years, and interestingly, also an NAACP member for the last 15 or so. Worked previously in Florida, and that's where my branch was, and now I'm a proud member of our Eureka branch, and it's a pleasure to be here with you tonight.
Hi, I'm Clark Sagata. I'm a faculty in the sociology department. My focus is in justice studies and critical criminology, and this is my first year here. I'm actually the newest faculty member of our department. I came via Arizona State University from that community, and particularly due to its geography. A lot of my work, of course, has been situated around immigrant communities and marginalized communities. A lot of the coursework that I'm designing now and that I've been brought in to teach here deals with social inequalities, and specifically I'm teaching a course now on police violence and how communities deal with these kinds of issues. So that's kind of my field about, and kind of how I broach things, looking at things from kind of a social justice perspective.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tay Triggs, and I actually am the Associate Dean for Student Engagement and Leadership here at HSU. And I've been here in the Humboldt community since 2012. I am a pretty active member in Arcata and Eureka, and I also have a child who is being schooled here in Arcata. I've also had a great time actually studying the shift in membership in supremacist groups for the last 10 to 15 years. I've been in higher ed for 15 years. And came here in HSU, like I said, in 2012, and have been really trying to work with some of the local schools as well in terms of some of the issues that we've faced with kids of color in the local school system. And I hope to continue that work.
Right. Hello. I'm very happy to be here. My first name is Lauren. My last name is Cannon. I teach in the philosophy department, and I've been here for about 10 years. My area of emphasis within philosophy is ethics, particularly applied ethics. I teach a lot of environmental ethics for the last 10 years. Also, a couple years ago, I developed and now teach a course in transgender lives and theory. So I teach that here at HSU in the CRGS, Critical Race, Gender, and Sexuality Studies Department. A lot of my own work in terms of my own philosophy involves questions about ethics, questions about the lives of trans people and how kind of an intersection between trans theory and philosophy of law and how certain legislation affects trans people and trans people who have also other potentially identities that make them more vulnerable than otherwise. Yes, and I'm happy to be here.
Hey, Young. Kutcher Risling-Baldy. Hi, I'm Kutcher Risling-Baldy. I am a Hupayurk and Karuk person here from Northern California. I'm also a new assistant professor of Native American Studies here at Humboldt State University. I just was at San Diego State University, actually, as a professor down there of American Indian Studies, so I'm happy to be home. I do a lot of my work on gender, feminist theory and research, and California Indians, and also on contemporary politics, and write a lot on the internet, on blogs and podcasts and things about sort of how contemporary politics affect Native American peoples and how we are a part of a very important national conversation that is happening around environmental justice and violence against women and things that are happening to us on the ground and then are slowly but surely showing that they're going to affect many other people in this world. And I'm very, very happy to be here. This is sort of my first Humboldt County event that I've gotten to do, so I'm excited to see everyone.
Well, thank you all for agreeing to participate. November 8th was a very interesting evening for me. It was the eve of my birthday, and I had great faith in humanity, and then the election results started coming in, and my faith in humanity started to diminish a bit. And then my birthday happened, and I shut down. And then I decided this is a time for empowerment. This is a time to engage and be energized. And that's why we're all here today. I've been asked why or if I chose to have supporters of the upcoming administration here. But that's not what this day is about. It's about the environment being challenged and affected. It's about rights of people of color being challenged and affected. It's about our country being affected. So that's why we're here today. So someone wanted to start with a little story. So let's start with that story right now.
All right. So you're okay. So I did mention to Lorna I had a story, a bit of a fictionalized story that I thought I would start off my piece with, and so I feel very fortunate to start off the whole conversation. So there's, as you know, there's a lot of things going on with regards to the new administration, with the people he's picking for cabinet posts. It's very scary, and so I felt like instead of kind of talking about disturbing legislations, disturbing cabinet picks, I did want to tell a little story. Now, my story is not a happy one, but I want to tell it so that those of us who don't have certain identities maybe can understand what some of the ramifications are of some of the policies that have been acted recently. I mentioned that I write a lot about trans theory and how certain legislation affects trans people and LGBTQ people. You know that in 2015 we had, you know, the right to marriage equality. That's wonderful. Since then, though, in 2016, there were over 150 anti-LGBT, particularly anti-trans laws that were put forward in the country. Three of those stuck. So that seems pretty good. There's many more, though. Now we see that a lot of those same laws are getting ready to be proposed again, and I'm worried that they might have a little bit more chance of being successful given the new Trump administration. So I have a little story. It's a couple minutes. Good? Yes. Okay. So in the story I'm about to tell, This is a story that I wrote. It's fictional, but it's compiled from a lot of personal stories that I've heard people tell. I am telling this story, so if you can't see me, I'm white and middle-aged. I don't look middle-aged, but I look younger than I am. So I'm a white middle-aged guy. I'm also transgender, though, and so that's one of the reasons I'm motivated to do this study and to think about these issues. So I want you to put your mind in this kind of scenario. So I want for you to imagine that you're a trans woman who is either fired due to anti-trans discrimination, which is not federally protected. You can be fired because you're trans. In California, we do have laws against that. Or that you're forced to quit your job because you're not allowed to use the restroom that corresponds with your identity, and using the other restroom puts you in too much danger. The laws that have passed on these bathroom laws are generally passed by those who have never met an actual trans person. You know that violence against trans persons is increasing, especially for women like yourself that are persons of color. Statistics show trans women of color, the violence has increased. We've had the most violent year last year of any other year before that. Now you don't have your job and you no longer have health insurance. You can't get affordable health care through the Affordable Care Act, and any health insurance regards your gender identity issue, your gender history, as a pre-existing condition. So they will not accept you for health insurance. Or what happens a lot, particularly at USTAP in California, till a few years ago, you would be covered except for anything that was related to your gender. So at one point, you have an opportunity for some employment, but it's a swing shift job that has you walking home quite late at night, 3 to 11, right? Maybe you know swing shift. You happen to know that trans women in your area are often stopped by police officers if they are out late at night because they are assumed to be engaged in sex work. A number of sources report that in such cases, the existence of a condom in one's purse is sufficient evidence that one is engaged in illegal activity, right? Not all purses are checked to see if there's a condom in there, but if you look trans and if you're a woman of color, chances are much greater that you're going to be stopped. So you don't take that job because you don't want to deal with the problem of being stopped by police because they think you're a sex worker. This part of increased surveillance is due to the idea of having more law and order by the Trump administration. So you think about the possibility of visiting family outside the U.S., but you can't go because they've increased the requirements for trans persons to get passports that fit their gender marker. That was something that was revised over President Obama and can be changed any moment. It is well known that trans persons often have trouble with TSA agents when we look non-binary or the gender marker on identification is different than what one would expect. So you can't have freedom of movement because you don't have a passport. And again, if you try, you're going to be put yourself in danger. And besides, even the more relaxed standards that got put in place in 2010, you need to have a physician attest that you're undergoing gender transition. You don't have a physician because you can't get health insurance. And so you can't do that either, even if it was either. So you attempt to get a cheaper apartment and go to the Office of Housing and Human Development. But you're not sufficiently helped there. You don't know why, if it's because you're trans, because you're a woman, or because you're a person of color. You remember that the head of this organization, Ben Carson, has had said that trans persons are, quote, abnormal, absurd, or beyond ridiculous. And you wonder if Carson's views are affecting his employees and their policies. So you finally have to move into a different part of town where you can get a much cheaper apartment. This is a part of town which is quite industrial. So you've got industry right next door. In fact, there's a new factory that many people are quite happy about, and you are able to get a job there. So see, people are happy. Trump has brought jobs back to the USA. So that's great. However, later on, you realize that this situation is not working out very well either. After 6 months, you notice that a lot of your fellow workers who've been working there for quite some time and also the people that live in that industrialized neighborhood seem to be having problems of a certain kind of respiratory ailment that no one's identifying. You are personally aware that due to a rollback in environmental regulations, the factory where you work has not been careful about its emissions, and it's not uncommon to fudge the numbers on certain reports. Statistics show that people who are vulnerable because of they're economically vulnerable, are much more often being living next to industrial hazards and much more likely to have the ill effects of those hazards. You worry about the industrialized toxins, but you really need the job, and you have nowhere to go. So the question is like, what do you do? What does that person do? So the reason I wanted to tell this story is when we think about the ramifications of the effects of some of the policies, some of what a lot of us here are worried about is people being intentional targeted and hate crimes, particularly for people who are read as Muslim Americans, have skyrocketed 122% in some areas. So there's intentional targeting. But there's other types of negative consequences that a person can get stuck into, like a perfect storm where they can't get out and live a flourishing life. And I tell that story because I want to think about all the different ways that we need to pay attention to what's going on in the country in the next few years and then guard against individuals being in the position of the fictionalized person I just described.
So can you call that a fictional story or a nightmare? Reality.
I mean, it's reality, and I mean, there's stories by people that are in these situations all the time. Now, in California, we trans people do have protections, and that's great. But even in the beginning of the year, there have been 5 more anti-trans bills introduced in different parts of the country, where a person like myself is not able to use the men's room. Right? Or if you do, it's in a whole other building. I mean, there's just so many odd ramifications. Right now, with regards to those who are in his cabinet, and I don't want to speak too long on this issue, but Ben Carson has said very negative things about trans folks. I mean, and Betsy Voss has supported organizations that say trans people are broken, that trans people should not be teachers. So I guess under that view, I would have to resign my position. We know the history of Jeff Sessions with regards to racism and also being anti-trans. And so I think we have to look far and wide with regards to how we're going to deal with some of the potential changes.
So you just mentioned Jeff Sessions. He is a cabinet nominee. And Jeff, I'd like you to take that this portion. Let's talk about him just a little bit.
Sure. A colorful character who is trying to be the Attorney General, and the NAACP is actively opposing his nomination, to the point where Cornell Brooks, the president, had a sit-in and got arrested, and to bring attention to Mr. Sessions, he failed to get through the Senate to be appointed as a federal judge. He was a senator, but as a federal judge in the South, he couldn't get through the Senate at that time, mainly at that time because he had made all these racial comments, and basically was overtly racist in several areas. And they're saying, that how can that person now be the guy in charge of enforcing all the laws of this country if he feels that, in his case, especially blacks are second-class citizens? So the NAACP is looking at trying to block that because through the legal system, they have a history that goes back, from 1909 to now, over 100 years. The NAACP has tried to use the courts, to make corrections, and there were some great successes that everyone's aware of. Brown v. Board of Education, the Civil Rights Act, these things were great accomplishments, and they're over 50 years old. All right, and if you look at it, since then, there were a whole slew of people at that time that were not happy with the Voting Rights Act and all these things. They didn't leave. And the way the NAACP sees it is they're here now and they're trying to flourish again. And so the battles that we thought were won and over are now potentially returning. The NAACP doesn't support individual candidates. They don't come out in that. However, once a candidate has office, they do take note of policies and appointments and become very active. And they say on their national website that, no, they're willing to work with any president. And if you look at it over the past 100 years, there have been some racist presidents that we've had to work with. And that's part of the problem is that you look at it that if you don't teach the true history of what was taking place in the United States based on race, it's easy to fall into the trap that the feeling, and it's not a good feeling now, is, oh my God, there's this overt racism happening now, and the world is coming to an end. Hopefully that's not true. It's not coming to an end, but, you know, it is a great leap backwards to a time when there was overt racism. Segregation, lynchings, all these things took place. President Wilson segregated the military. In 1925, there was a 25,000-member Ku Klux Klan march in Washington, D.C., with crowds cheering. So these things happened in America. In other words, it was overtly racist, and that was the norm. And we got away from that. And now with Trump being elected and the appointments he's making, we're looking at, oh, my God, here we go again. And related to this is a focal point that if we have a three-part system, it's supposed to be checks and balances, you know, the executive, the legislative, and judiciary. Well, if you look at the executive and say from a racial standpoint of people of color, not going to get a lot of help there. So the check on that would be, let's go to the legislature. And what's happening in Congress is not very encouraging. And that is something that in 2 years hopefully can change, because a lot, you know, congressmen are perpetually running for office. And the third is the judiciary, the Supreme Court. Well, the Supreme Court's history, everyone remembers the great decisions they made, and for every one of those, there was over 100 that were totally awful. You know, before, you know, they got rid of segregation, there were hundreds of decisions saying, no, the races should be separated, blacks were inferior. That came from the United States Supreme Court. And when you get to, you know, civil rights and other actions, workers' rights, same thing. And so the NAACP was fighting that for decades and finally made progress. And then, you know, the slippage occurred that if you have it, and nobody really knows why, but, you know, we're going backwards. And this, and what happened now was when President Obama got elected, racism's gone. We've elected a black president. Well, I guess we now know. No, there's always a member or members of our society who are racist. And, you know, and the thing about America is you have a right to be racist, but you don't have a right to make those policies and implement policies that make me suffer because of your beliefs. Right? So with Jeff Sessions, I think it's Jeff, isn't it?
Beauregard.
Beauregard Sessions. I get my own name here. With Mr. Sessions, it's like they see that as one of the first steps. You know, we don't know what is President Trump, he says a lot. I don't know where he's going because it constantly changes, you know. So, but this appointment, they said no. And I'm sure they're going to come out. I just saw some of the Secretary of Education, and I'm like, it would be funny, but it isn't. You know, another unqualified person going to be in charge of educating everyone in our country. And the problems with education, a man wrote a book in 2005 and said at that time, our schools were now as segregated or more segregated than 1965. Many don't know that. It's like, it is true. It may not be here, but nationwide, that is the case, and for different reasons. It's not because of restrictive housing and so forth. It's based on economics. So it all gets tied together, and I think from the NAACP's point of view, what Nashville's trying to do and here at the local branch is to say, all right, how do we step up? How do we make sure you've got laws, they have to be properly enforced? If they're not there, how do you get them? And who needs the help and assistance, and who needs to stand up?
Absolutely. And we must remind everyone that the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People isn't a black organization. Yeah. It's the oldest civil rights organization in the country for civil rights, not black rights, not white rights, but for civil rights.
Yeah, I guess for radio, I'm also white. I told my wife I'm middle-aged, and she said, you were middle-aged. and whites, the NAACP cannot function without the support of the white majority. And so we're looking to pull everyone together to go forward and do what's right, because the nation was founded on racism, and there's institutional racism in place, and now that's coming back around, and it's like, how do you deal with that?
Absolutely. Dr. Risling, no, pronounce your last name one more.
Risling.
Risling Baldy. you grew up in this community. Like you said, you are a Hoopa. Tell me what this upcoming administration means to our native lands here.
I've done quite a lot of thinking about this since the election, and there's sort of a couple of schools of thought. One, which is, we as Native people have a very unique relationship with the federal government. They are tasked with a trust responsibility with us. They are supposed to uphold treaties that they made with us. And we have yet to have an administration that has been stellar at doing those things. So we have always been right on top of over 500 years of survival and resistance against what is sort of a colonial mentality of how a government is supposed to be put together versus the government that they learned from, because they were supposed to have learned from us how democracy was going to work, and what we had created was a way of representing people, and they were like, that's a good idea, we should do that, except we don't want women in there. And then the Indians were like, you need women. Women are very important. In fact, it was, a Cherokee chief who told them, that's why you guys are going to have problems, because you can't even include women in what you do. Like, you're so far behind, right? So we kind of enter into this thing as like, well, we are always ready for what we need to do to make sure that these responsibilities are upheld. And we are always in that position of sort of demonstrating that we are capable enough and smart enough that we are going to hold the federal government responsible for what it's supposed to do. And that our voices are always used as a way to sort of show the way that people sort of always have to resist against what's happening at the federal government level. So there's that line of thought. But when it comes to Trump, you know, I think a lot of Native people see that there's a very personal vendetta that he has against Indians. That I often compare him to Andrew Jackson, actually. Mm. And not even in like a cute way, like they have a lot in common. Like 35% of me kind of thinks he is Andrew Jackson. that maybe Andrew Jackson like made some kind of deal where he gets to still be alive and he's been waiting for the right moment. Because they have these same mentalities. And one thing that people have said about Andrew Jackson is they kind of really glossed over how much Andrew Jackson hated Indians. And I think that with Trump, when you look into his history, people kind of gloss over his real disdain for Indian sovereignty, his real disdain for the role that Indian people play in this country. We have 567 independent sovereign nations that exist in our lands, and we have elected people who probably couldn't even tell you that and have no idea what sovereignty means or what it's about. So I think that what's really good about us is we're not going into any situation having not been through that before. Mm-hmm. But what we see is it's going to take a lot more to educate the right people about how to have that conversation. They often compare us to, they say Indian people are the miner's canary of whatever's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And if you see that they are coming after us very, like, hard because they're trying to prevent us from being able to do something, that's the start of what they're really trying to do. And so what you saw, or if you have been watching, hopefully, at the Dakota Access Pipeline, the way that they treated those water protectors, the things that they're still doing, there's posts now about how they're bringing in military-grade weapons still, even though we're still peacefully protesting, that's what's going to continue to happen at a grander scale for people who are asking for things like clean water. So if you look at what we've been doing, I think you can look to us too for, instead of thinking, what do I do? Start to think, what are all the ways that I can educate and resist what is about to sort of come forward now? Because we've been doing it for a long time, and it makes for some really good stories, so, you know, and some really great community gatherings, so I know that it's possible.
You mentioned the Dakota Access Pipeline. Let's just think about the nominee for, or the candidate for cabinet for EPA. And right now, you have the Army Corps of Engineers. They're battling with the folks who are doing the Dakota Access Pipeline from doing an environmental impact study. That is the bare minimum of what should have been done before this was even proceeded. So can you talk about that impact?
Well, you know, I think that, sadly, that is a continuing method of a lot of the federal government's ways of trying to continue projects that they know are probably not beneficial to the environment. So if you look at what's been happening with the dams here in Northern California, they've been trying to get them to do an environmental impact statement for like 20 years. And this is under an Obama administration. This is under a Bush administration. It's still the same kind of things. What I think that Trump is doing very blatantly is he's nominating people who are not shy about the fact that they are financially invested in the completion of pipelines and in the building of dams. And he's also not shy about his financial investment in those things. He's also said he's not going to divest, and he doesn't think a president can have conflicts of interest, and they're above that. And yet, if you look at what he said before, he's been very clear that his investments are what sort of drive what he's going to do. And his investments right now are in pipelines, and they are in casinos, and those are two things that Native people are very involved with. So what we're seeing is this means that we have to be very very blatant and kind of wear our activism on our sleeve, right, to not be afraid to speak up in every situation about what's going on. When it comes to sort of who they're appointing, it's like we have to be very clear about what that means for other people. If they're not going to do an environmental impact study on their pipeline because that's the investment that they have economically, then understand that they will do that in your community with your water. Like, we're not just protecting our water. We're not saying that this is only for Native people. We're saying this is everybody drinks water. Everybody needs water to live. What we say is water is life. So if we're doing this, it's to sort of help you to understand you have to step up just as much as we do, because this is everybody's deal. And that's what I think is going to happen as he sort of puts these people forward who are very blatant about the way that they're sort of going to avoid all ability to say, I don't have some kind of conflict of interest. They're not shy about it because he's not shy about it. So it's just really calling that out on every occasion.
Yes. If you're just tuning in, this is Thursday Night Talk, The Race Beat. I'm Lorna Bryant, broadcasting live from Humboldt State University's Kate Buchanan Room. The numbers to call if you'd like to join in this conversation are 826-4805, 1-800-640-5911, or via text at 707-492-5478. In a few minutes, we will open the floor up to questions. Jessica Eden is my floor co-host, and she will be passing around a mic and fielding questions from the audience. Now, Clark, I'm going to go to you. You are a visiting professor in the sociology department. There is a department within that in justice studies. Have your students been talking about how this upcoming administration may impact their field or justice in general?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks so much for letting me join the conversation. You know, I think right now there's just a tremendous amount of uncertainty, and that uncertainty sparks, you know, a range of different emotional responses. I really want to thank Lauren for, you know, kind of bringing to light, I was really thinking through as he was telling his story about how sometimes we put an overemphasis on the actual event of violence. Like when something occurs, then we can label it as like that was a violent event. But we miss the fact that the violence is always there. Whether or not it manifests itself is often immaterial. For the person that's experiencing that condition of fear or living in that condition of fear, the violence is always there and is always ongoing. Mm-hmm. And this is something we've talked about in a number of our courses in sociology. One of our a book I immediately thought of, you know, after the election happened and we kind of got back together in class and we kind of started processing through it as a class, one of, you know, many of the students kind of re-resonated with this book that I'm sure some of you have read, Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. It's very accessible. It's kind of like it become required reading in our department because it tells a very simple story, and it's about a very accomplished journalist now rewriting a story to his son and trying to communicate to him his experiences of growing up as a black man in America and what that means for his son, even though his son is going to be growing up in a much more privileged situation than he was. And what Coates really brings to light in that writing is that if you're a minority and a person of color in this country, specifically if you're from the black community, then everything you do is from a position, from an existential condition of fear. That fear conditions your life in almost every way, down to deciding as a child which route to take to school. And he uses that to kind of show that it's always there and it's always present. So that he and this is his way of reading, you know, black culture. But he says, even in the hip hop and even in the girls on the corner and the boys talking tough, it's all done out of fear. That's actually the motivating platform that you have to build yourself up, because there's always this fear there. And that fear just has such real effects on people's lives. You know, I came from Arizona, and I remember in 2010 when we passed the SB 1070 laws, which were kind of known as the Show Me Your Papers laws. You know, there was those on the right who said, well, if you're legitimate and you've got papers, and or if you're a citizen, even if you're pulled over and, you know, legally profiled now, it's no big deal. But they really missed the point. I mean, they missed the point in so many ways. But there's a disconnect there in not understanding what it is to wear a skin, a color, be in a body that is constantly being surveyed, where your mere presence is inviting state surveillance and perhaps more harsh policing tactics. And so I just think that that's something that isn't talked about enough, in the sense that by only focusing on the acts of violence that, you know, after the election, people said, well, they started recording, well, there's been swastikas painted here and this and that, and then that's kind of died down. And it's like, oh, we're kind of returning to a normal. Like, no, that wasn't the violence that I really sensed was being felt within the communities that I deal with. The violence was immediate. The violence was a return of a fear. For people who are here on DACA, the thought that that could be erased with a signature, it's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. And that's something that's very difficult to know how to even talk students through or friends through when they come to you and they just say, I'm just scared. That's it. I'm just scared. And it doesn't matter if they can list off policies or laws or all these rationale for it. It's that fear that they can't shake that's going to condition and structure every moment of their life. And it's not acceptable that at this time in history we ask half of our population to live in fear of those kinds of things.
Absolutely. In the next hour, one of the panelists will be, I like the way she puts it, a documented student. So we will talk about that. Chief Peterson, speaking of which, how is the university preparing for this upcoming administration with DACA students, with the fear of immigration raiding nationwide, basically? What is the university doing with the police department?
Well, I think probably the thing that would be most effective is to read Chancellor White's words. And he basically stated our position in three very declarative sentences, and those are: the CSU will not enter into agreements with state or local law enforcement agencies, Homeland Security, or any other federal department for the enforcement of federal immigration law. Our university police departments, including University Police Department here at UPD, Humboldt State University, will not honor immigration hold requests. And our university police do not contact, detain, question, or arrest individuals solely on the basis of being or suspected of being a person that lacks documentation. I happen to also be the president of the Law Enforcement Association of Humboldt County, the Chiefs Association, and in conversation with my counterparts, the sheriff, the local area commander for CHP, the Arcata Police Department, the Eureka Police Department, we're all unified in this basic concept that we will not, do not, cannot operate under anything other than these guidelines. So we look at people as Chancellor White does.
I'm sure our campus is more than happy, ecstatic to hear that. There may be a small population that may not be, but I'm guessing the people in this room and the people listening are in agreement and happy that is taking place. And hopefully this will become a sanctuary state for the state of California.
If I could, too, Jeff spoke earlier about the NAACP, much on a national level. We've recently elected a new president here at our local level, and Liz Smith is dedicated to the cause of justice, and I'd like to invite anybody who might be hearing my voice right now to look into getting involved in our local branch. I think it's a great way to get involved at a local level that'll have a national impact.
Full disclosure, I am the social media person for the local branch of the NAACP, and I can say the September meeting, it was a regular same old eight people. The November meeting, it was probably 15 people. The December meeting, it was probably 30 people. And actually, Chief Peterson is our incoming vice president of that NAACP as well. But we saw the support of the NAACP in our own community on Monday. Yeah. The Eureka Police Chief invited the community to march in solidarity with the NAACP in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. He said himself he was expecting maybe 30 people, maybe 40 people, but 500 plus people were there in support. And during that march and the subsequent celebration at the Dorney Center, applications for membership, we ran out of them. Yeah. So we don't have, do we have applications here?
No, I didn't bring any, but I'm happy to talk to anybody joining ZZ. You know, $30 a year.
You can do that. I don't think I can solicit in this capacity right now, but thank you for saying that. That was subtle. So Tay, you are the student engagement and leadership dean or associate dean here at Humboldt State. What has the buzz been around with students since the election of November 8th? What have you seen? What have you felt? What have you experienced since that day?
Wow. It feels like it was so long ago. Was anyone else with me on that? But it really wasn't, right? You know, I think right after the elections, there was a real active buzz, I think, on campus in terms of, in my experience, a lot of students feeling a lot like you described earlier in terms of your birthday and just really having high hopes of what was going to happen and not necessarily getting the outcome they expected. And I think part of that it's because maybe many students felt the way that I did in terms of I thought we were at a certain place. And so in my mind, I thought, oh, that'll never happen. You know, not with all the very public things he keeps saying, you know. And so I think a lot of students were in shock the day after, just not fully understanding what that mean, replaying in their mind all the press conferences and interviews and presidential debates that happened and what was said and, you know, are any of those things going to come to fruition? And if they do, how is that going to impact me? And how is that going to impact the people around me and the people that I care for? And, you know, I think the campus in a lot of ways showed up for the students, but also for each other. Like, you know, we're faculty, staff, administrators, but we're human. You know, you don't cut off your whole personal life as soon as your car hits the circle drive at the library, right? Like, you bring that with you everywhere that you go, and I can't be two Tays. I'm just me. And so being able to navigate how the students are feeling and supporting them, and I don't just mean the students who are upset. I mean the students who full out support this new administration. And as a faculty staff administrator, your job is to support all students. And being able to navigate that and navigate how you personally feel is very difficult. And I've been in higher ed for a long time. Well, I feel like it's a long time. I mean, I started young, and it feels like it's been a long time. This is the first time that I feel like I failed at that. I absolutely found it impossible to come to campus and to cut off thinking about, as a single mom, how this new administration is going to impact me financially. I am still afraid, you know, to the point where I'm now thinking about side hustles. You know, what side job can I get? Because this is going to impact my taxes. This is going to impact, you know, I really felt strongly that this new administration hates women. So, and more than hate women, they hate single moms. It's almost like we're being punished for being a single mother. And so a lot of what people don't understand about some of the tax laws that they're going to try to pass is going to really impact many of us. Yeah. Many of the people who voted for this administration don't even understand that they voted against their own best interest. Mm.
They will and soon so, enough.
Well, and you know, I feel that's sad. And part of what we did today, we went over a speech that I'm sure many of you are familiar with, Dr. King's Drum Major Instinct speech, and we talked about our sermon, and we talked about that sermon, and we talked about how he defined the drum major instinct, that need to be out front, to be better than, to be superior than. And, you know, people look at when you can't do it financially, you do it in other ways. And so it becomes very surface things. My car is better than yours. My house is bigger. I make more money. My kids dress better. I can afford to put Jordans on my kid, and you can't. And then when you don't have that, you rely on even more superficial things like color. Mm-hmm. Well, I may not have all those things, but I'm whiter than you. Mm-hmm. And we know that in America, that means something. And we've allowed it to mean something over decades, when in actuality, we know it means nothing. And one of the things that Dr. King talked about, and if we really think about it, the people of color who were searching for and demanding their civil rights, poor white people should have been right along with them, because they were also being dehumanized and treated badly, and allowing the people who are, you know, this small percentage of people who are making the money to stay at that level and stay on top, and using something like superficial race and skin color to keep us separated. Because if that wasn't introduced, we would all be working together because we feel like we deserve better. So for me, when you have the haves and the have-nots, you're always going to have racism.
Absolutely.
Until we address why there's this percentage of people who are, you know, have tax laws and their benefit and they're making more and more and more and don't want to give back at all as if they didn't benefit from anybody else, we are always going to have racism because someone in that group is always going to only have skin color. That is the only thing they're going to feel they have to be superior than someone else. And that's sad. But one of the things I will say positive about our students, man, are they resilient. Because regardless of how they were feeling, they still showed up. They still went to class. They still did their work. They still do programs across campus to benefit their fellow students. And I am very impressed and proud of them for supporting one another and being there for one another. So I know you can't shamelessly plug, but I'm going to shamelessly plug. our HSU Day of Solidarity, which is tomorrow. And as I've said to many people, you know, the purpose of that day, and I'm speaking on behalf of the coordinator, so hopefully I don't get this wrong. The purpose of the day is not to make anyone feel bad that they voted for this administration. It's to show support for the people who are living in fear. To show them that, you know, when you see Chief Peterson across campus, he is someone you can stop and talk to and say, this is how I feel. This is how I'm feeling right now. And his involvement is a way to show you, I see you.
Yes.
Not only do I see you, I hear you. And so we're hoping people turn out for that reason, if nothing else, to show your fellow student, faculty, staff, community member, I hear you and I see you.
Absolutely.
And I need to be heard and seen. Mm-hmm. And so that is happening tomorrow, and that's one way that HSU has showed up and showed out.
And we'll get more information about that in the next hour. I think Jessica has a
question. Well, we have a listener from Eureka who's loving the town hall and everything that people are talking about and would like to add to what you were saying, Tay, about how we can locally be vigilant and show others our support. So any other ideas folks have about locally what we can do?
And be mindful, we have about 4 minutes for the next 4 minutes before we take a break, and we'll play a little music and switch out. So keep your comments brief for this next part.
Yeah, and Jeff Blank with the NAACP is, yeah, join the local branch of the NAACP, and there are local branches of other organizations here that are doing good things. I know the feeling was I have to create something new now to deal with this, and it's like, unfortunately, no, this has been going on. These things have been going on, as Tay said, for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And now what it is there's a resurgence, and it's kind of like, you know, it's a big swing that we don't want to have happen. So look for your local organizations. A lot of them have websites. You can figure out what they're doing and join, and you're going to need to get active because, as Donald Trump has said, you know, he's coming for the Muslims. It goes, who's next? Mm-hmm. You know, and you look around the room and it's like, you know, people of color, Jews, whoever, and there's a rise of that attitude. Mm-hmm. And then we have to stop it.
Absolutely. I'd like to thank all of the guests in the first from this first hour. Jeff Blank from the Eureka branch of the NAACP, Chief Don Peterson from Humboldt State University Police Department, Dr. Clark Sagada, Criminology and Justice Studies at Humboldt State, Tanza Trey Tiggs, Associate Dean of Student Engagement and Leadership at HSU, Dr. Lauren Cannon, Philosophy Department at HSU, and Dr. Kutcha Risling-Baldy, Native American Studies Department at HSU. Again, the numbers to call if you are interested in joining in this conversation, and there is someone in the studio taking your calls, and then we will transcribe them and read them here live in the Cape Buchanan room. That number is 707-826-4805. If you're outside of the listening area, you can dial 800-640-5911 or text your question directly to 707-492-5478. And one more thing. We are on Facebook Live right now, and thank you to our sound and social media engineer, Mike Dronkers, for making that happen. I think you have another question.
I was just wondering if we had any questions here that we could slip in before the hour closes with these particular panelists.
Thank you. I have a question for the chief. I really appreciated everything that you had to say, and especially the fact that you're working with the other chiefs in the county. I imagine that you are also talking with the other chiefs about the what-ifs. The what-ifs of possible federalization of any of the police forces, about the mobilization of National Guard, anything like that. Have you thought or talked about that at all?
that's being talked about at a lot of levels, and I think we're fortunate to live in the state of California. Just this evening before I came here, they had legislators that were speaking about what they're going to be doing. The state of California hired a former Attorney General, Eric Holder, as a watchdog, frankly, to keep an eye on things and make sure things do not slip and get out of hand. And I think California is going to take on a huge leadership role. And we talk about the population of the state and what that represents in terms of economics. And we have a very, very loud voice. And I can speak candidly. None of those things that you talked about are going to happen here on this campus. Not on my watch, not on Dr. Rossbacher's watch. It's just not something that we would ever allow to happen.
Thank you. I'm going to turn it over to our in-studio engineer, Michael Roccaforte. We're going to play a little bit of music and give the panelists a time to swap out with the upcoming panelists in the next hour. Thank you for joining us. Bryant, and joining me on the second hour, I'll have my guests introduce themselves.
Well, good evening, Lorna. I'm Gary Eagles. I'm Humboldt County Superintendent of Schools. I really appreciate the opportunity to participate in the second hour of the panel presentations. I was very impressed by listening to the issues that were brought up during the first hour, and I hope I'm able to contribute a little bit here during the second hour. I've had the privilege of working in public education now for a little over 45 years, so I think it makes me one of the oldest panel members up here, so I passed middle age a long time ago. but with that said, I hope that I'm able to bring a perspective to tonight's issues because they are very important focuses of conversation and should be in every community across America tonight.
Thank you.
My name is Alex Bowman. I'm a school psychologist with the Humboldt County Office of Education. I am almost in my 10th year in the county, having moved here from Arizona and previously Virginia. Grew up all throughout the Deep South, so when we think about what our own personal backgrounds bring to this conversation, there's a lot for me to think about and consider in there. I have gotten to work with almost every elementary and middle school in the county during my time here, and so my joy in coming to this community has to learn what it has to offer as a community. I've been very involved with working with the preschool populations and get to do a lot of work with individuals on the autism spectrum as well. My role has been to help support children who have needs. And I think that as we move forward, that's the greater portion of the question that I hope to help support finding resources for.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Carla Sanchez. I'm a student here at HSU. I'm a third year in the psych department as well. I'm the president of FREE, which is Finding Resources Through Empowerment and Education. And our goal is to strive to find resources for students like DACA, mentored as what it is, or undocumented students, and as well as AP 540. And yeah, I identify as a documented student, so we'll be talking more about that.
Hi, I'm Terry Uweki. I'll describe myself as a 25-year-old Asian woman with decades of attitude for the listening audience. I am recently retired from the California Center for Rural Policy here on campus. And I did program evaluation and facilitation. I did community academic partnership work, everything ranging from evaluating tribal suicide prevention programs to doing CBPR work in breast cancer research. And now I'm really glad to recommend to stand for the C in community academic partnership and moving over from the A side. I am a co-organizer for the Women's March on Eureka. That is something that is a new title for me in the last 3 weeks. It started as a twinkle in our eyes about mid-December, and we kept saying, after the holidays, and it just ramped up this month. So I represent many, many women who have been working around the clock to make this happen, and I'm really excited to talk about it. So thank you.
Good evening, Lorna and everyone. My name is Renee Saucedo, and I'm proud to work at the College of the Redwoods as their Director of Student Equity and Success. I'm very happy and excited that some of our students are in the audience here tonight. I am also proud to serve as a steering committee member of a new organization that we have put together within the local Latino indígena community called Centro del Pueblo. Our mission is to offer services to the Spanish-speaking community here of Humboldt County. Particularly, we're putting together a legal services program because, as people know, our undocumented community has to travel as far as Santa Rosa just to get legal advice around their immigration cases. We're going to be putting up a cultural center and also be doing leadership development, empowerment, and organizing within the Latino community. And I've just been an immigrant rights and racial justice organizer, activist, and attorney for a long time. So very happy to be here.
Thank you all for agreeing to be a part of this. Now, in the first hour, we talked about some of the legal ramifications of this administration that will take effect in just a few short hours. I want to talk about some of the personal effects. Our children in the school system within Humboldt County, children who immediately began experiencing trauma and racism and terrorism from fellow students, how are we navigating through that, both in our homes and at school? What steps are, what are the effects of the documented students? And talk about the empowerment of women that we will see nationwide and actually worldwide on Saturday. And we'll talk a little bit about Renee's personal story of, God forbid, things, maybe a sign of things to come in the next 4 years. Let's start with you, Dr. Eagles. Tell me what you've experienced or seen or heard post-election within the Humboldt County region for the schools. Has there been an uptick of bullying or violence related to students saying now you have to go home to your native land, or incidents of racism like that?
Well, interestingly enough, Orna, a lot of those types of conversations actually came up before the election was finalized. It was during the very visible run-up to the election during late September and October in terms of the public dialogue and what was going on through social media. And while it's not a requirement for the 31 school districts that I help support here in Humboldt County to report to me specific incidences, there were conversations with me about an increasing sensitivity that people had to these issues. I know Alex is going to talk about some of the systems in place that schools have put in, even before this became an issue, to try to put a stop to these kinds of issues. My colleagues, and there are 57, of course, because there are 58 county offices of education, I can tell you that throughout the state, there were some very significant incidences that occurred, again, coming up to the election, as well as afterwards, because there was a sense of validation that the kind of demeanor that went through the election process was somehow now okay. Mm-hmm. As an elected official, I have a different type of reaction than what others might have. So I react from that standpoint, and I react from the standpoint of an educator who's trying to advocate on behalf of all children everywhere throughout this county, and not only just in this county. As part of the elected official network for county superintendents, we try to represent the needs and interests of all students throughout the state. And we want, first of all, the message to be that students are safe, that schools are a safe place to be. And if there are incidences that arise because some of the adult population in this nation turn out to be bad mentors, then we need to counteract that. But we need to do so not through punishment, but through taking those opportunities to educate and talk about what it means to respect yourself and to respect others. We can look to the fact that though there may be changes at the state level in terms of opportunities for undocumented residents, we still have the California Dream Act that exists in this state. And I believe, as the chief indicated in the first hour, he's very pleased that he's here in California, and I would hope that everyone in the listening audience is pleased to be in this state. And I agree with him that California will emerge as a leader in protecting the rights of everyone living here in our country. There was a 1984 Supreme Court decision that forbade public schools throughout this land to separate services between students who were citizens versus students of families who were not citizens. So that is the law of the land. I do not believe that law will be changed, although some have speculated what happens when a new Supreme Court justice is appointed, but I still don't see that issue. So enrollment occurs in public schools in this land regardless of immigration status. Additionally, we have protections in schools that in California that no personal information can be dispensed to any law enforcement agency of any kind without parent permission, except in two very, very limited ways: by court order or an emergency health situation of the child, his or herself. Okay? So I want to just set that parameter. But I also want to say that I am concerned about the welfare of all children, even those not only of color, but also of those who are suffering, for example, special ed or learning disabilities, because of the appointment or the proposed appointment of Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education at the national level. And if there's one message that I want to resonate tonight, is that what happens in Washington does affect Humboldt County, California. And if there's one thing about this election that should be emphasized, is that this is an opportunity for people to rise up and to make their voices heard about what they believe is right and what they believe is wrong. And as some of the folks in the first hour talked about, many of the issues that are now coming to the forefront we thought were put behind us. I mentioned I've been around for a while in education. Well, that's because I've been on this planet for a while. And I was able to listen to Martin Luther King's speeches and to work through the civil rights era. I had the opportunity, even myself personally, to participate in some of the early 1970s protests along with the United Farm Workers, Cesar Chavez, in the southern San Joaquin area in the lettuce and grape boycotts. But today we have a nominee for education that doesn't even know that the Individual with Disabilities Education Act is a civil rights act at the federal level that protects the opportunity for children with disabilities to have access to education. As I said, as an elected official, that really bothers me to see people who are being appointed to key positions, and in this case in education, but it happens in other secretary positions if you look at the nominees, who are unqualified to serve. Because Ms. DeVos, regardless of her political philosophies, has no background in public education. As a matter of fact, has a record anti-education. But she is not qualified to run a department for which she doesn't understand even the basics of the laws that govern the educational opportunities. And when I have a president-elect who suggests that he wants to take $20 billion of current education dollars and devote them to charter schools. And then he in turn appoints a Secretary of Education who wants to totally privatize public education and to do away with our public school system, which has been the core component of the development of this country since its founding. That concerns me because of my role to advocate on behalf of the needs of all children in this county. If I can't rely on a federal government that believes that all children are valuable and their rights should be protected, I'm concerned.
Thank you for saying that. Absolutely, thank you. I don't have a child in school any longer, but I have a grandchild who will be entering in the fall. And it's a scary time. Which brings me to you, Dr. Bowman. What are we doing at the county level to counsel, to offer safe space for our students who are facing trauma?
An hour is so little time to go through all of the various things that have been invested in countywide. I can speak to that, or I could respond to that question from a county level. I think that I could just as easily respond to that question at a district or site level, working within various schools. At the broadest sense, I think that I do have to take a perspective that is inclusive of all children. That is my role. That's how I see my role within my field, is to be a voice for those who don't have an opportunity to be heard otherwise. In education, we are very fortunate that the people involved in our field are helping people. That's part of the focus. That's why we come to work in the way that we do with the people that we do. And all helpers need guidance at a certain point. We all have great intention. We don't always know the right approach or technique or methodology. And that's a big focus for what the county has invested in over the last several years. If I were to speak to the potential trauma that may be a part of this massive change that our nation is facing, I would like to also consider that trauma is ever present within the communities of our nation. In many senses, we are fractured. We are not able to identify and provide for those who are in need, despite our intention. What has been a real beautiful aspect of moving to this area is the nature of the community that's found here. Not only community in the sense of a county, but identity in the sense of the specific town and even the school site where a child and their parent and their grandparent may have all attended generationally. Excuse me. We know a lot more about trauma than we have in the past. We know a lot more about how it can impact development throughout the course of the lifespan and how that can then influence our achievements and where we go, what we can do, and what we can accomplish. There are countywide efforts to help support increasing our general educators' awareness and understanding of some of the techniques that are available to support individuals as they are experiencing some kind of difficulty through the course of their development. I think that we will always strive to reach that outcome. I think that this moment in our nation's history is presenting a lot of opportunity to see how some of those techniques may be applied. And so I support that, you know, we have a large cadre of psychologists, counselors, other mental health professionals who are available. And those individuals who are having difficulty, who do not feel as though their voice is being heard, they all have an available ear within hearing distance. And it's that message that I think our schools are really attempting to promote for the children and their families.
Thank you. Carla, you are a DACA-mented student. Tell me what that means.
I've fallen under the program of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival, which is an executive act that President Obama signed in June 2012. And that gives me and other folks the right to work or have a work permit. But in order to do that, we have to pay a fee that now just went up on December 23rd of $495 in order to have a work permit. And that allows us to, be able to work without being so scared of, like, especially up here where there's not a lot of jobs, especially. So that's every 2 years you have to reapply, go again to Santa Rosa to go get biometrics, go through the first, when you first apply, you go through very rigid, they check everything. There's very long requirements that you have to do. It's paperwork, very jargon, like all jargon-based, but, you know, I'm proud to be that. I come from Mexico. My parents migrated here when I was two, so I don't remember much of my native town or my native, but I still identify as that as well. So, yeah, I came to HSU, and now I'm a psych major as well as I'm in the rowing team. So even though I'm undocumented, people, like, don't know that. And it's hard to come out at first, but eventually you gain force. You have people who support you that have always supported me, especially when I was here, when people didn't believe in you. You know, every day, people, or, like, throughout my life, nobody has believed because you are someone, or you don't exist, or you don't have a voice, or you fall under certain laws that don't protect you. But, you know, we do have power as well. We might be small, but we do have a lot of power. And here in HSU, that's what we lack. We lack that they don't support us. They don't know who we are. They don't give us resources. And that's when I got here in 2013. Somebody in the financial aid department told me that I wouldn't succeed here because for this reason, I couldn't afford it. Or the DREAM Act doesn't give enough money for, like, documented or undocumented students. And that kind of disappointed me because I didn't know where to go. I didn't know who to see. People were directing me to certain other people that didn't know what to do. So, you know, EOP didn't even know how to help me in that unless I had to go to student group that, like, for example, that's how I got into FREE. And they helped me house me. Like, I didn't know these people, but they opened their houses for me, which to me was very inspiring to some extent because I knew someone was here to support me. And it wasn't HSU. It was, like, the Humboldt community as well as the documented friendly, you know, which to me has impacted my life because I'm still here. I haven't gone anywhere, you know. And even when I think of that lady who told me that, oh, it just enrages me every day because I'm proving her. I'm telling her I am better than I'm the same. Nobody knows that. There's no difference in me. You know, I'm succeeding. I'm no alien. I'm a strong individual. I'm a strong woman, a woman of color, especially.
So, so, Carla, this university is recognized as a Hispanic-serving institution, but you're telling me that there aren't
services?
No. Services in place for...
We've been asking for a document center, which we haven't even got. We got people to people, especially with Richmond. We haven't gotten that. Like, we've talked to Peg Blake. Like, we've gone through very rigid processes with different administration. We haven't, like, gotten anything. You know, it's very important. Other CSU, other UCs have this. Why can't we? Are we too small? Like, these are the questions that I'm asking everybody here. Like, we are a small population, but that doesn't mean we're excluded from everything else, you know? That, like, I am also important with this university. I pay tuition as well, out of my pocket. You know, other people get financial aid. I don't that much. You know, I still have to pay out of my pocket.
So tell me what the student-run organization FREE, what it stands for, and what are the services offered through that club?
FREE stands for Finding Resources Through Empowerment and Education. And the services they provide is, they do wonderful, amazing things that I'm very proud to be part of as well. And they help, when DACA first came out, they helped put together the paperwork. We do communities. We know the ACLU very well as during the fall semester we do Indocu Week, which is a week of awareness of undocumented students. We show films to show HSU and the community that to be aware of those individuals, those folks. And we find support through, even within the community. We work with Renee as well as like different other folks to help support these students, how to find aid for them, how to direct them. If you need housing, that can be with us, because housing is really expensive here, honestly. And I didn't get to experience that housing. You know, I had to work my first year. I had to work more than 20 hours to live here. You know, my parents didn't support me that much. And again, financial aid wasn't an option to some extent.
Terry, so not much of an activist in the past.
but
what happened?
Well, I've been here about 10 years, and I realized that it actually sort of got reawakened in me, because when we first moved here, my husband was the new city manager of Arcata, and at that point, we had been married 15 years. And if you are married to a politician, you can't get in front of people and tell them what you believe in. And so I always had to kind of keep it on the down low. And I don't want to say I got used to that, but that was a role that I had. I'd say when this all first started by somebody putting a call out, hey, you know, some of us have been talking about maybe trying to organize a local women's march. And I was interested, as were a handful of other women. So we showed up. This was in the middle of December, right before Christmas. And we managed to have one more meeting before then, which I volunteered to facilitate, because that's what I used to do in my job. I didn't know I was signing up to, like, be the co-lead of this incredible thing that's just mushroomed since the first of the year. But I think so many of us were feeling depressed and wanting to do something and just not knowing what to do. And this really seemed like an action that we could take. And I think it requires a lot of courage to take action, whether it's coming up here and sitting on stage and being on a live radio show, or if it's being an ally to somebody that you don't know, that you feel you can step up to the plate. Those are the kinds of actions that can take place on a personal level and maybe on a larger level. So people have asked, okay, why are you marching? Why are you interested in the Women's March? Well, I can say personally, I'm the granddaughter of immigrant parents from Japan. And I'm the daughter of parents who, with their families, were interned in incarceration camps during World War II. So I know what it's like, or my parents know what it's like, to have an executive order coming from the president in which your civil rights are completely dashed, no matter if you're a citizen, and they can lock you up. Does that sound familiar? When I first heard about what Trump was saying, I thought, this cannot be happening again. I couldn't believe it. And so, you know, I am committed to standing in solidarity, of course. I'm also the daughter of my mother, who campaigned for Eugene McCarthy. So I have to admit, you know, a little bit of that runs in my family. And my father was a scientist. And that's really was what I retired from, was science and research to help provide data to inform rural policy. That's the mission of CCRP. I've been a single mother who relied on the safety net, that it looks like there's going to be some really big holes in that safety net with this current administration. And I am now this month a single woman on Obamacare. And just coincidentally, but I had made all these appointments because I was waiting till I got my my new insurance card. So this week, I've had boom, 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 one appointment after another, not knowing, of course, at the time I made the appointment, that who was going to be elected and that might all go away. So I have very personal reasons for wanting to be on this march. And all the women who are joined in this all over the world have their own reasons, but there is something that we are united in, and that is to stand up basically for human decency and human rights. Our very first meeting, we just shared, you know, why are we here? What do we want our theme to be? And we all landed on the same thing. It was to come together. Instead of saying we're anti-Trump or anti-Republican, no, this is nonpartisan. We want to talk about what is it that we stand for. And lo and behold, then the Sister Marches organization got together, and we found their platform is exactly what we had been saying. And this is what women are saying all over the world. Every day, if you Google Sister Marches, the number of marches that are happening all over the world, from apparently Antarctica to Iraq. Can you imagine having a women's march in Iraq? And so it's, I feel like this is going to be unprecedented and historic. And I'm so excited to be a part of it, because all you do is you just ask, well, we need some help doing this. And women are just jumping in, and men also. So the question has come up, can men come? Yes, of course. Then we got into trouble because saying men, women, and children didn't sound inclusive enough. So then we really had to define all genders, all ages, because I've been saying we want this march to be something that second graders can be at and your grandmother. So no violence physically and no violence verbally. Of course, we can't control that, but that's what we're trying to put out. So I'm just going to read what the mission is of the women's marches, because it's right in line with how we all feel. We stand together in solidarity for the protection of our rights, our safety, our health, and our families, recognizing that our vibrant and diverse communities are the strength of our country. In the spirit of democracy and honoring the champions of human rights, dignity, and justice who have come before us, we join in diversity to show our presence in numbers that are too great to ignore. We stand together recognizing that defending the most marginalized among us is defending all of us. We support the advocacy and resistance movements that reflect our multiple and intersecting identities. We call on all defenders of human rights to join us. This march is the first step towards unifying our communities grounded in new relationships to create change from the grassroots level up. We work peacefully while recognizing there is no true peace without justice and equality for all. So it is our hope that the march this Saturday, depending on what the weather is, but we're kind of expecting at least 1,000 people. There's been a lot of controversy. Apparently in other cities across the country, that there are women who are showing up that maybe have different views on reproductive rights. And so the question comes, do they, you know, what do you do about that? Well, you cannot begin to work together unless you listen to each other. And we need to respect each other no matter what those beliefs are. And so I am never going to shut the door. There's no way you can talk if you're going to say right up front, you can't stand next to me. And that's my personal view. And there may be others on the march who feel differently. But we want to practice what we're preaching. And it's really, it's all about love and not hate. In fact, that's one of our slogans we're going to say. Love, not hate, makes America great.
Thank you. If you're just tuning in, this is the second hour of a special Thursday night talk, The Race Beat. I'm your host, Lorna Bryant. If you'd like to participate in the conversation, you can call with your comment, 707-826-4805. The 800 number is 640-5911. Or you can text your comment or question, 707-492-5478. My co-host Jessica has a question or comment.
Yeah, we had Nelson from McKinleyville, and I'm imagining this will be interesting. He says that Obama promised change and had a divided House for his whole presidency, and Trump has also promised change but has a fully united House, so why not give him a chance?
Let's let that fester for a minute. Let's let it ruminate just a little bit. To allow Renee Salcedo to speak a moment. Why don't you tell me what happened? You took a little vacation not too long ago, didn't you?
Yeah, I wanna share my story because it's important to highlight what's happening to a lot of families, not only here in Humboldt County, but all over the country. But before I do, I just wanted to say, Lorna, put it in context that I, too, as my fellow panelists, have heard lots of stories from people who we work with and who we are in community with. And I just wanted to share that working at CR and working with families in the Latino community, I have heard stories in the past few weeks about mothers worrying about their children who are yelled at by fellow students saying, go back to Mexico where you belong. I have been around gay men who sob to me saying that they are worried that their partners will be attacked because they are immigrants and how concerned they are about the future of gay marriage. The dreamers, like the compañera here, when I have been giving workshops to students, in particular to the dreamers, about what options they have and what their legal rights still are, the anxiety and the fear and the terror is just hard to describe, and you see it in their faces and in their tears. The Muslim families in our region, what they must be feeling right now, and what are we doing to reach out to them? Because to have to choose around the possibility of registering or remaining clandestine from the federal government is terrifying to me. There are people who I know in the community who are so depressed right now that they couldn't go to class after the election and they couldn't go to work. And there are families, immigrant families are predominantly mixed status-wise, which means that in our families we may have citizen grandkids and permanent resident parents and undocumented grandparents. And so the whole family is impacted, and the entire family is just terrorized that the kids might get home from school at the end of the day and not find the grandparents or a parent at home. In this context of fear and terror, and these are real stories here in Humboldt County, I feel it's important for me to share, as someone who never thought it would happen to me. You never think it would happen to you. And then coming back from Mexico in November of 2016, I was traveling back from Mexico with my family, including my mom, who lives here with us in Humboldt County. And she was detained by ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, and she was deported back to Mexico that same night. My mom is almost 82. She has been diagnosed with dementia, complicated by her diabetes, anxiety, and depression. And the ICE agents wouldn't even allow me to talk to her, to try to explain to her what was happening while they kept her in secondary detention. The ICE agents could have used their discretion, which they legally have, to release her to me, her U.S. daughter, her only caretaker. And instead, they left her on her own to travel back when she didn't understand what was happening. She could have died. And I am one of the lucky ones because we were able to get my mother back for a combination of reasons. Because I'm a U.S. citizen, because of her age and medical condition, And because I have worked in the immigrant rights movement for so long, I had connections. And I had a larger community who helped me get her back. But I'm telling you, I was ready to cross her, even if I had to walk her or carry her over the border. This is family we're talking about. And millions of families are being torn apart, just like my family almost was. I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, and I'm sharing this with you all and putting myself out here and my vulnerability, not because I feel like a victim, but because it's important to put a human face on the suffering, because that's what's happening, and unfortunately, that's what I anticipate is going to continue to happen at a much heightened level. So when people talk about how they're terrified, believe them. It's real. And I can't even imagine being separated from my 7-year-old son, which is what some immigrant families have to go through. Or even the fear of that is just terrifying. And my U.S. citizen son asked me after this incident happened, "Mommy, are you going to be deported just like my abuelita or grandmother was?" These are the levels of trauma that our families are going through. So if we get emotional around our current political climate, this is why. The suffering is real, Lorna, and I think it's important for people to understand that this is not just another election. Deportations have been happening and separation of families has been happening for years and decades. But now we're looking at a whole other level. And building of the wall at the U.S.-Mexico border, you know what message that sends to me and my family? I'm a U.S. citizen, but I'm no longer welcome here. I am not welcome by my country. And people don't care enough about me to think that this is so serious that they discuss it instead of normalizing the racism. I am a stranger in my own country, I am sad to say. And I have the privilege of having my U.S. citizenship. Can you imagine families who are still undocumented? It's terrifying.
Absolutely. So we have about 20 more minutes of this program, 7 of which have to do some housekeeping. So that leaves us 13. Yeah, my math is okay. About 13 minutes. So looks like Jessica may have another comment.
Well, there is another call that came in, but I wanted to open it up a little bit to see if anyone here had any questions for the panel.
Well, what about the panel answering that question about giving the upcoming administration a chance?
I'd like to throw out just a comment in response to that as I heard that question. In our country, we have a tradition of giving the next president and his or her administration. We haven't had her yet, but that may happen. Maybe in my lifetime. But we give the next administration an opportunity. But here is the concern that I have as an educator, and I'll answer it only from that perspective. It appears by the data on surveys that have been conducted that a significant majority of Americans do find themselves floundering in this great pool of anxiety over what will happen next. There's also a large percentage of individuals who, while they may not be floundering, are not sure that Mr. Trump is qualified to serve as, in that capacity, as the leader of the free world, is what we like to phrase the President of the United States. You know, normally we look to the public record, the public political record of what an individual is going to do in the future with what they've done in the past. We have no record to draw on, at least not the kind of public record we're typically looking for. So, in absence of a record, we have to look to the words that are spoken, the vision that may be created, the policies that may be espoused. And we've heard about some of the concerns about the policies
that Mr. Trump espoused during the campaign, the vision he portrayed. But I would also say that a lot of our anxiety is also based on the fact that a lot of the words that he spoke, he also contradicted. So there's a lot of uncertainty about what he does represent. So what do you do when you're not sure where somebody is coming from? You look at their actions. When it comes to education, I turn to who he has nominated to lead the public education system of the United States. Not just the K-12 public education, but the education secretary also influences higher ed. But Betsy has called public education system a dead end. She prefers to see schools as business enterprises that should be competitive, rather than understanding that they are civic institutions foundational to our republic. She believes in funding options for parents, which is a nice catchphrase. But then when you look deeper, what does she mean by that? She wants to provide more funding for parochial schools without accountability. Now, we do have a belief in a separation of church and state. And when you take an office at her level, you swear to uphold the Constitution of the United States, just like Donald Trump will do tomorrow. I worked over 35 years ago for Eureka City Schools at a time when Title I, federal monies, also went to support certain church-run schools, St. Bernard's Elementary as an example. But the funding went specifically for reading and math instruction. It wasn't given to the parochial schools to run their school and to teach their religious classes. It was specifically prohibited. She sees no boundary in that regard. But interestingly enough, her advocacy for church-run schools begins and ends with Christian-run schools, conservative Christian schools. I don't have anything against conservative Christianity, but utilizing public education dollars to foster that, that does concern me. That is not an appropriate separation, church from state. The other aspect that I'm concerned about is she wants to support company schools, and I call them that. Profit-making K-12 programs where businesses will come in and earn profits, and corporate executives will earn profits rather than spend the money they get on the children they are charged to serve. As somebody in public education who scrambles for every dollar possible to be able to meet the needs of children, and we don't have enough, she wants to take the limited dollars we have, as does President-elect Trump, and redirect it to corporate profits. Businesses should not profit on the educational programs of children. Children should benefit by the public's dollars. So when I believe the individual's name was Nelson, says, why not give Trump a chance? Because he has a House of Representatives and a Senate that is Republican and likely will have a Supreme Court also dominated by conservatives within the next few months. Those concern me, knowing that he has a majority that may be on his side with that vision and that appointment leading our public education system. I don't really want to give him a chance to accomplish his vision. And I'll go back to some of the civil disobedience issues that have been talked about. We need to monitor closely the actions of all of our elected officials. We don't want to react. We want to respond. We don't want to become hysterical. We want to become focused. And voices count. If there's one thing we learned in the 60s and 70s in promoting civil rights, is that voices sustained over time, focused on the future and the betterment, works.
I would like to add to that as well. Give him a chance. He might have a first-year spot in this country. How about the people who don't? There you go. Like, you know, and that's scary. Like, the day after the election, that was scary for me, you know, for my family, for people who don't. Like, he might have, give him a chance. It's his vision, like he was stating, it's terrifying because it's happening, and it happened out of the, like, you don't know how to process. When you were on campus, it felt like someone died. You know, it was morbid. And people didn't want to teach. People didn't want to even be here. And people were, yeah, there's things to worry, but there's people that are endangered right now, like the population, like myself, you know, of losing DACA. What am I going to do? How am I going to work? How am I going to survive? I have this degree. Now what? I can't work. You know, if he takes that off, what's going to happen? You know, and people don't understand that because it doesn't affect you. You're not part of that group. Unless it affects you directly, you understand. You know, and I want to say that very clear because it's affecting a lot of people I know. And, you know, it's very heartful, like with Renee, what I heard that happened to her mom. You know, that could have been anybody's mom, you know.
And that's a perfect segue. Sylvia and Eureka, I guess, wanted to reiterate that she feels Trump's policies would only benefit the ultra-rich and undo a lot of positive gains made by the previous administration. So I think you addressed some of that. I'm not sure if you want to tackle this just yet, but Mike in Crescent City wants to know about the possibility of Trump being impeached.
Well, what does the audience feel about that?
Does anybody from the audience want to say something? Questions? Anything? I'll come right to you.
And we have about 4 minutes.
Thank you, Lorna Bryant, for hosting this. As we sit here and talk about the things, like, what are we going to do, what are we going to do, what are we going to do, I feel like, as a college graduate, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to law school. I'm going to get into these, like, positions of power, whether it's a education board or a healthcare board or something like that. There's a lot of people that I know encouraging themselves to get up into these higher levels of education or administration so they can even be at the playing field. So especially if we're going to be on a college campus having this talk, students are listening. There's a lot of rhetoric that we gain by going to a university, but the rhetoric can be put into action if we do something after graduation, right? And talk after talk after talk, and being in mourning about Obama leaving the White House, but at the same time hating Hillary, being disappointed about Bernie. I mean, it all takes so much time. And we're putting all of our faith in individuals without putting our faith in ourselves and our own self-power, you know, to go on and do something with our education. There's a huge, huge lack and, you know, disconnect between what sometimes is said on a university about inclusion and about diversity, and to the point that Carla just made, not everyone has access, you know, and not everyone's even history is told properly in their classrooms. We talk about education being inclusive even at the K-12 level. You know, how many days are spent on Black history? Is it just in February? Are we doing Black history all year? Do the students know they're on native land being in Humboldt County? I mean, what are we talking about even at the K-12 level? So that's a point that I want to make. And I want to also, you know, we learn from our history without magnifying it. You know, things have happened in the past. Will it happen again? I think that's very alarmist. You know, Betsy DeVos is not in charge of education. You're in charge of your own education.
So, okay, you're up.
Please be brief.
We
We can go over a little bit. I just got the go ahead.
Oh,
so.
Okay. Well, thank you.
I don't have anything special to say. I think a lot of people said very important things tonight. I just want to acknowledge that you three ladies shared your own personal experience tonight, and I want to show appreciation of that. I know everybody has their own personal experiences, but these three ladies, they share part of their lives with us and the listeners on the radio. And I know that moves me, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll come to you in just a second. I've got a young listener here. Do you want to say something?
No? Well, my son here, Carlo, 7 years old, and he's been listening. He's been hearing a lot of things. He's already has a bit of an analysis about what some people have been saying, and he wrote down, which he wants to hold the sign which says, "Let there be peace on earth." Oh. That is what he said.
Thank you, Carlo. Thank you.
I just wanted to say I keep hearing two words, fear, and I think that's Trump and like-minded individuals' greatest weapon. And then I heard Terry mention love, and I think that's our greatest weapon. And if we come together in love and unite and find that common ground, which we know how to do here in Humboldt County, we can move past Trump and all the chaos that he keeps creating and fear that we're feeding off of that is his and like-minded individuals' greatest weapon.
Mm-hmm. May I add another word? Another word in it for me is resistance, in the sense that our new president now is threatening the lives of our families. It is life and death for many communities. And so for the immigrant community, for example, tomorrow we're holding a press conference as communities of color to say we're going to be asking for the county to become a sanctuary county. We're going to make sure that the sheriff's office doesn't share information with immigration. We're going to make sure that racial profiling stops within our institutions. Et cetera, et cetera. So I just wanted to add that we locally have a lot of power to not have to accept what is being proposed at a national level. Is it going to be difficult? Yes. Will it take courage? Yes. Will it take sacrifice? Absolutely. But I think that now is the time. And so everyone is welcome tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. in front of the county courthouse. Be in solidarity with communities of color who are going through a lot of this stuff, who are going to say, these are experiences, but we will resist, and we will survive, and we will flourish in this community.
Absolutely. Anyone here like to emphasize or share again the information about the Day of Solidarity here on Humboldt State's campus? If anyone would like to just where to get more information about that, humboldt.edu. Again, it's a Day of Solidarity for everyone on the campus. Okay, Celeste.
Good evening. I'm Celeste Robertson. I'm an advisor with the Education Opportunity Program here at Humboldt State. I am the coordinator of the Day of Solidarity tomorrow, along with a bunch of other fine people who have joined from different offices to help bring this together. It initially started out with one of our advisors, Elias Pence, who wanted at the day after the election, we had so many students coming into our offices because our program, EOP, as it's referred to, works with first-generation students, students who are the first in their family to go to college. Many of our students are undocumented students, and when they came into the office the day after the election, crying upset, worried about their families, worried about themselves, whether or not they would be able to continue their education here, we decided it was time to do something. It started out with Elias coming up with an idea of posting a banner on the window, his office window in EOP. Then it moved to my thinking, maybe we should do a rally for EOP students out in the quad. Then it became, let's do a day of solidarity. Show the university that we all stand together as a family, because, as you know, each in a family, there are always disagreements. There's always that one uncle, that one aunt, that one grandpa that doesn't see eye to eye. So we have planned a wonderful day of activities for you. Tomorrow rather, at 1 o'clock here in this same room, in the Kate Buchanan room, we will have activities set up. We're going to have massage therapists. We're going to have people helping you to do yoga. We're going to have food and food and food. We're going to have a ball pit so you can jump in and toss those balls around like you did when you were 3 years old. Yeah, you know you did it. And then we're going to have art therapy so you can sit down and color. You can talk. There's going to be music and whatever. At the same time, from 1 to 3 in the South Lounge, which is down the road a bit in this building, we're going to have a reflection piece. You'll be able to go in and write on butcher paper that's been posted all you feel about what's going on in this country and how it is affecting you. If you feel as an African American, this is difficult. As a member of the LGBTQ community, this is tough. As an undocumented student, this is rough. You can write, and then you can write and tell what you feel you need in order to survive this turbulent time for you. Then from 3 to 5, over in the Great Hall, we're going to have a speak out. You can stand up. You can talk about what's going on in your heart, how you feel about the direction of this country, how you feel that others have been affected that you've talked to, and what you hope to see for the future. There's going to be food there, too. All right, there are going to be brownies and cookies and lemonade and hot chocolate, vegetable trays, but, you know, whatever. So then, at 5:30, we're going to move down to the Great Hall, which is over the marketplace, and we're going to feed you a nice, good pasta dinner with garlic bread, salad, and something to drink. No, not that kind of drink. Okay. So, and then from about 6 to about 7:30, we're going to have two of the major groups on campus, including Check It, to help you understand what it's like to be a good bystander when you have to intervene. Say you're sitting somewhere and you hear someone being accosted. You know those Mexicans. You know what they're like. You know those gays. You know those blacks. How you can stand up and challenge that in a way, no, not with fist, although you might want to, but how to do it peacefully. How you become an ally to another person, to a group, to a cause, to a people. So we should be through about 7:30 tomorrow night. But we're going to have games and other stuff going on at the same time throughout the evening in the Great Hall. So come. I invite everyone on this campus. The president on down has been invited. I've invited every student, every faculty member to come and staff member to join us. And all of those in the community within the sound of my voice who would like to learn and share with us and show that there, in spite of all the turbulent times, that there can be peace, there can be dialogue, exchange of ideas. We might not agree all the time, but we can at least talk to each other and respect each other. So I invite you to please come.
Thank you. Thank you. So we are stepping on the toes of another show that should have begun at 8 o'clock, so I'm not going to take up any more of that time, but I would like to thank Dr. Gary Eagles, Dr. Alex Bowman, Carla Sanchez, Terry Uwecki, and Renee Salcedo. Thank you to the first hour panelists as well. Thank you to Geraldine Goldberg, our Thursday night talk producer, Katie Whiteside, the KHSU program director, Kevin Sanders, the broadcast engineer who is making this remote broadcast possible right now. Thank you to Michael Roccaforte, our KHSU studio engineer who is manning the board right now and fielding those questions. David Reed, our interim general manager. Mike Dronkers, our board operator and social media person. It looks like David is social media right now as well. The KHSU staff and volunteers for their support for this event. And Rob Enge, who volunteered an hour of his time of his show this evening. Thank you also to the University Center staff and dining services for allowing us this space. And thank you to Jessica Eden, tonight's program coordinator and co-host. Thank you all for participating. Thank you, and thank you for listening. I look forward to more remote broadcasts, more dialogues like this, and more times for us to share in these conversations. Going to end with yet another song and then toss it over to the studio. I've always wanted to say that. I got my opportunity. Over to you, Michael, in the studio. Thank you.